particularly the city of Raqqa, which if you look at photos of it, it was, you know, buildings were completely destroyed. So I think, you know, everyone should be learning lessons. It's not one set of rules for the enemy and a different set of rules for yourself. You know, if they're supporting the ICC in this context, they might understand the need for a strong international criminal court for generally.
Well, Joanne Mariner, we don't want to have a problem with victor's justice. So much for being with us. Crisis Response Director at Amnesty International. I'm Amy Goodman.
I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out, so make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Department of Transportation to spend $412 million on highways. Biden repeals controversial immigration ban, Title 42. And, in international news, Sri Lanka protests gain momentum amid historic economic crisis. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 1st. 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The Oregon Department of Transportation is spending $412 million of federal transportation funds to repair and construct its highways. The funds were provided as part of President Biden's $1 trillion Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, a bipartisan infrastructure package that critics say was passed at the expense of much-needed social welfare and environmental legislation. Oregon received $1.2 billion total. Most of that money is set aside by the federal government for electric vehicle charging stations, natural disaster protection, and public transportation. The $412 million being spent on highways is from the discretionary portion of the package. Environmental and transportation activists have been pressing the Department of Transportation to invest more of that money in sustainable transportation projects, such as road safety, bike and pedestrian pathways, and public transit. Activists and lawmakers supporting a green pivot expressed disappointment in the final plan. A new report has revealed that Oregon is the sixth highest state ranking in domestic extremism incidents in the nation over the last decade. These statistics, as reported from the Secretary of State, largely pertain to incidents associated with the 2020's nearly nightly racial rights demonstrations in Portland and during an aggressive pro-Trump demonstration downtown where a person was shot by a counter-protester. The ranking is also influenced by incidents like December 2020's breach of the Oregon State Capitol building by right-wing Reopen Oregon demonstrators. According to the report, Oregon is one of only 16 states that doesn't have any legislation defining or criminalizing domestic terrorism or domestic violent extremism at the state level. Sociologist and extremism expert Randy Blazak said, quote, "We have a long history of extremist groups in the state," end quote, and noted the state has been a hotbed for white supremacist groups and militias. Another significant incident supporting the report occurred in 2016, when a group of far-right extremists took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Events date back further, including a 1984 incident with the Ron Each group intentionally giving hundreds of people salmonella, attempting to limit voter turnout. Following the release of the report, Secretary of State Shemaiah Fagan in the Oregon Audits Division announced an advisory response that identifies efforts that state agencies can undertake to thwart future incidents of domestic extremism. On Wednesday, Fagan said, quote, "Oregon must be an inclusive place where everyone feels safe, and the rise in domestic terrorism in Oregon is an immediate threat, and we cannot simply wait for the next incident to occur," end quote. Fagan maintained immediate steps can and will be taken to prevent individuals at risk from becoming radicalized and becoming violent. Oregon released its first annual Oregon Early Childhood Inclusion Report yesterday. It outlines our progress in that area, including whether certain indicators are met across the state. According to federal data, about 48% of young children experiencing disabilities in Oregon receive all services in early learning settings. Some feel Oregon's programs still need improvement to be fully inclusive. Oregon Department of Education Early Childhood Coherent Strategy Specialist Meredith Villines said, quote, "Since the Individuals with Disabilities Act was developed 30 plus years ago, children experiencing disabilities have limited access or are often asked to leave care even in preschool. So we're hoping to change that," end quote. The report says Oregon is showing improvements statewide in some indicators, including policies, funding, and sharing new guidance. Three Oregon counties also showed progress in meeting community indicators, including building awareness and providing access to training. Going forward, the three counties plan to sustain funding and scale inclusive practices. The counties have already set goals to bring more children to school.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the murder trial begins for an Oregon romance novelist accused of killing her husband in 2018. The Senate Judiciary Committee deadlocks over the Supreme Court confirmation for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. And in international news, Ukrainian official says hundreds of civilian bodies were removed from areas retaken from Russian forces. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 4th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The high-profile murder trial for Oregon romance novelist Nancy Crampton Brophy began Monday at the Multnomah County Courthouse with opening statements. Crampton Brophy is accused of killing her husband, Daniel Brophy, a chef at the Oregon Culinary Institute, on June 2, 2018. She was not arrested until September of 2018 and has pleaded not guilty to all charges. Crampton Brophy was once a prolific romance novelist, publishing books like The Wrong Lover and The Wrong Husband. The trial began with the judge announcing that her 2011 essay, entitled How to Murder Your Husband, will be excluded from the evidence in the trial. In that essay, Crampton Brophy wrote, quote, "As a romantic suspense writer, I spend a lot of time thinking about murder, and consequently, about police procedure. After all, if the murderer is supposed to set me free, I certainly don't want to spend any time in jail," end quote. Daniel Brophy arrived at the Oregon Culinary Institute for work on June 2, 2018, and disabled the alarm for the building at 7:21 a.m. According to court documents, he was the only person known to be in the building at that time. A co-worker of his arrived at the building at 7:30 a.m., but Brophy's body was not discovered until 8 a.m. when students were allowed into the building. He was located in the rear kitchen. He had a gunshot wound in the back, which authorities believe paralyzed him, and he was shot once more in the chest. Detectives also determined that Crampton Brophy had been downtown between 6:39 a.m. and 7:28 a.m. Shortly after the shooting, Crampton Brophy surrendered a gun to police, which matched the style of gun that was used in the murder. Later, she asked detectives working on her husband's murder case to send her a letter stating she was not a suspect, so she could give it to her life insurance company to collect what she told police was a policy valued at $40,000. However, authorities learned of several policies Crampton Brophy could collect upon Daniel Brophy's death that totaled up to $1.5 million. According to court documents that were unsealed in 2019, Crampton Brophy and her husband shared an iTunes account. On the account, an article titled 10 Ways to Cover Up a Murder was bookmarked. The trial will continue on Tuesday. The Senate Judiciary Committee deadlocked today on whether to bring the Supreme Court nomination for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the full Senate floor. The Senate committee deadlock does not permanently block Jackson's nomination, since Majority Leader Chuck Schumer plans to discharge Jackson's nomination and send it to the full Senate. Democrats still hope to confirm Jackson by the end of the week. So far, she has undergone more than 30 hours of hearings discussing her record and qualifications. If confirmed, Jackson would be the first black woman on the Supreme Court. She would also be the third black justice and the sixth woman in the court's history. In addition, Jackson would be the first former public defender on the high court. The committee deadlocked along party lines, the first time that has happened since 1991, when a motion to send the nomination of current Justice Clarence Thomas to the floor with a favorable recommendation failed on a 7-7 vote. That committee then voted to send the nomination to the floor without a recommendation, and Thomas was ultimately confirmed. In breaking news, Democrats now appear to have at least three GOP votes in favor on the full Senate floor, including Susan Collins, Mitt Romney, and Lisa Murkowski. It is unclear whether any other Republicans will join those three. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky said last week he cannot and will not support her, citing GOP concerns raised in the hearings about her sentencing record and her support from liberal advocacy groups. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina voted for Jackson when the Senate confirmed her as an appeals court judge last year. However, Graham said last week that he won't support her this time around. It seems unlikely Democrats will need to use Vice President Kamala Harris' tie-breaking vote to confirm President Joe Biden's pick. Biden called Collins on Wednesday to thank her after her announcement. It is expected that all 50 Democrats will support Jackson, though one notable moderate Democrat, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, has yet to say how she will vote. Ukrainian authorities on Sunday accused Russian forces of committing war crimes and carrying out massacres around the capital of Kyiv, specifically in the capital of Bucha. The bodies of 410 civilians have been removed from Kyiv area towns that were recently retaken from Russian forces. One group of nine bodies, all in civilian clothes, were scattered around the site that residents said Russian troops used as a base. They appeared to have been killed at close range. At least two had their hands tied behind their backs, and one of those was shot in the head. Another's legs were bound. Ukrainian officials said the killings were evidence of genocide, but Russia's defense ministry rejected the accusations as a so-called provocation. The discoveries followed the Russian retreat from the area around the capital, territory that has seen heavy fighting since troops invaded Ukraine from three directions on February 24th. Moscow now says it is focusing its offensive on the country's east, but it also pressed a siege on a city in the north and continued to strike cities elsewhere. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said fresh sanctions from the West would not be enough to respond to Russia's atrocities. The war has already forced more than 4 million Ukrainians to flee their country, and many more to leave their homes. In the port city of Mariupol, about 100,000 civilians are believed to be trapped with little or no food, water, fuel, and medicine. The International Committee of the Red Cross said Sunday that a team sent to help evacuate residents had yet to reach the city. Ukrainian authorities said Russia agreed days ago to allow safe passage from the city, but similar agreements have broken down repeatedly under continued shelling. The head of Ukraine's delegation in peace talks with Russia said Moscow's negotiators informally agreed to most of a draft proposal discussed during face-to-face talks in Istanbul, Turkey this week, but no written confirmation has been provided. Many charity organizations are working on the ground in Ukraine and are in need of donations, but experts are warning that scammers are beginning to take advantage of people looking for ways to help Ukrainians affected by the war. Eric Tegetov has more on the story.
Many people are looking for ways to help Ukrainians affected by war. However, they should be on the lookout for scams. Lynn Heider with the Northwest Credit Union Association says, unfortunately, emergencies breed fraud. She says credit unions in the Northwest have been heartened by the outpouring for Ukraine, and so there are a few tips to keep in mind with donating. Heider says people should look for well-established charities.
Consider charities that have global reach, that have experience going into situations like this and providing on-the-ground services that are very effective.
Heider points to two organizations based in the Northwest, Mercy Corps and World Vision, as examples of charities already in Ukraine providing assistance. The Better Business Bureau says it's already seeing scams pop up. Heider says the organization is a good resource for looking into charities' legitimacy. She says people also can check with credit unions because many are directing funds to established organizations. There also are tips for what to avoid, starting with crowdsourcing sites.
Be leery of those unless you really know the organization. If you get an ask for cash, checks, or gift cards, don't provide that and do not provide any of your personal banking information. There's never a reason to do that.
Hyder says people have options if they've been scammed.
If you feel you've been the victim of fraud, file a complaint with your state attorney general's office because they will take it seriously and investigate. Also, you can report it to the Federal Trade Commission by visiting reportfraud.ftc.gov.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
There's a new unpredictable COVID-19 variant that has been detected in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said the Omicron subvariant known as BA2 is becoming increasingly significant in the U.S. Another variant, Omicron BA1, caused the most recent surge in infections, but according to scientists, BA2 seems to be more contagious. The BA2 subvariant is now responsible for more than half of U.S. COVID cases, as well as a growing percentage of cases in Oregon. The new variant is occurring in the setting of a global decline in coronavirus, and experts do not expect a big spike, as we saw with the original Omicron wave. The BA2 variant is causing problems in places like Hong Kong, where much of the population still hasn't been exposed to COVID-19 and a lower percentage is vaccinated. Also, the variant seems relatively unlikely to reinfect people who've had BA1. In the US, most people have either contracted the virus, gotten vaccinated, or both, which will likely dampen any potential new wave. Experts still say older adults and people with certain medical conditions such as obesity or those with weakened immune systems are at elevated risk from the virus when community infection rates go up, and they should prioritize getting their booster shots. The CDC did recently recommend an additional booster for people aged 50 and older. The COVID-19 hospitalization rate in Oregon is at just 10% of the peak it reached in February, and case numbers in the state are near their lowest point since the pandemic began. Ukraine accuses Russia of a massacre in a city on the outskirts of Kyiv, and the U.S. House mulls pandemic aid for hard-hit businesses. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Stand with Ukraine and pray for us. Help us. Close the sky over Ukraine. Please.
Ukrainian Americans gathered outside the White House to call for more support for their homeland as Russian forces build strength in the eastern part of that country. Ukraine accused Russian forces of carrying out a massacre in the town of Bucha amid reports of civilians lying dead alongside roads and in mass graves. Russia's defense minister denied the allegations. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia's withdrawal from the north is slow and cautioned many dangers remain.
The first one is that the bombing may continue. The second is that they are mining all this territory. Houses, equipment, even the bodies of people who were killed. There are a lot of tripwires, a lot of other dangers.
A White House spokesman warns the invasion is far from over and promised continued military, economic, and humanitarian support. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Sunday said the administration continues talks with European allies about tightening sanctions against Russia. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump argued at a weekend rally that President Biden's handling of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan opened the door for the conflict.
This invasion of Ukraine would never have happened if I was in the White House, not even a chance.
The Senate Judiciary Committee today takes a step towards the first black woman joining the Supreme Court when it votes on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's nomination. Full Senate approval could come as soon as Thursday. Jackson's expected to be confirmed, given the support of every Senate Democrat, along with that of Maine Republican Susan Collins.
She clearly had the credentials, the experience, the qualifications, and the integrity that I look for in a Supreme Court justice.
Jackson's confirmation would not change the court's makeup, with six justices generally voting as a conservative majority. The House might vote this week on a small business pandemic aid package to help restaurants and other hard-hit industries. The $55 billion cost would reportedly be offset by unspent money from prior relief packages. First Lady Jill Biden joined the president Saturday at the commissioning of the USS Delaware, a nuclear submarine.
The state of Delaware has loved the Bidens and cheered for us in most of our triumphant moments. It has carried us through the darkest times in our lives with a kindness that asks for nothing in return.
The First Lady is the sub-sponsor, a role intended to bring the vessel luck. A native tribe in Virginia has reacquired more than 450 acres of sacred land. Phones Cliff is the ancestral home of the Rappahannock tribe. It will be placed in trust with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and open to the public. In 1608, the tribe defended the cliffs against Jamestown settler Captain John Smith, although they were forced from their land 60 years later. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast from Making Contact, with a look at the state of youth activism in Russia from 2012 to today. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, it's Let's Talk About Race. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy, with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy, with a high of 55 degrees. Today in history, in 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. is fatally shot while standing on the balcony outside his second-story room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. The civil rights leader was in Memphis to support a sanitation workers' strike and was on his way to dinner. He was 39 years old. The quote of the day is from American Baptist minister and leader of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "People fail to get along because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they have not communicated with each other," end quote. Tesla CEO Elon Musk just acquired a 9% stake in Twitter, becoming its largest shareholder. He did so in the face of rising questions about the social media platform's dedication to free speech. Musk purchased 73.5 million shares, worth about $3 billion. His regulatory filing says he bought the shares on March 14th, and they described him as a long-term investor. Musk acquired the shares before beginning his public dialogue on the First Amendment and Twitter. He had even raised the possibility of starting a rival social media network. The Twitter stock purchase comes as Musk is locked in a dispute with U.S. security regulators over his ability to post on Twitter. Musk's lawyer has contended in court motions that the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is infringing on his First Amendment rights. In October of 2018, Musk and his company, Tesla, agreed to pay $40 million in civil fines and to have his tweets approved by a corporate lawyer, all after he tweeted about having the money to take Tesla private. But the funding was not secured, and the company remained public. Nonetheless, Tesla's stock price jumped. The SEC brought forward a securities fraud charge, alleging that Musk was manipulating the stock price with his Twitter posts. The SEC is also investigating Musk's November 6, 2021 tweets that asked followers whether or not he should sell a 10% stake in Tesla. Shortly after the November tweet about the Tesla stock sale, Musk began selling off shares. He wrote on Twitter that the sale would go to pay tax obligations estimated at $10 to $15 billion, but some of the money could have been used to buy the Twitter stake. Musk's revelation about his stake in Twitter comes 2 days after Tesla released information about its first quarter deliveries. The company delivered 310,000 vehicles in that time period, slightly below expectations. Twitter stock surged more than 22% at the opening bell today. A new bill just signed in Washington State creating an alarm system for missing indigenous people could be a model for other states. The Navajo Nation is considering repealing its ban on same-sex marriage. And tribal and federal officials say an agreement to hand over more than 400 acres of land to the Rappahannock tribe in Virginia is a triumph. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. A new bill just signed in Washington State creating an alert system for missing indigenous people could be a model for other states. The Olympian reports the bill, signed by Governor Jay Inslee, is the first to establish an alert system for missing indigenous people. The bill was introduced by State Representative Deborah Lakanoff, the only Native person in Washington's legislature, and was created in consultation with area tribes. The bill creates a hotline to take in reports from the public and alerts law enforcement officials and sends out public messages when indigenous people go missing. The system is similar to the Amber Alert system for children who have been abducted. The Olympian reports State Attorney General Bob Ferguson says other states have already contacted him about implementing similar legislation elsewhere. The Navajo Nation is considering repealing its ban on same-sex marriage. Emma Gibson from the Mountain West News Bureau has more.
The Navajo Nation lies within Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, and has approximately 400,000 members. Almost 20 years ago, it banned same-sex marriages. Alray Nelson heads the LGBTQ Indigenous advocacy group Navajo Nation Pride. He says the ban has resulted in problems for partners who want to adopt, build a house, have joint health insurance, and more.
In order for us to really feel safe in our own communities living on the Navajo Nation, the nation has to open up its doors and send a message to the rest of the country that the largest tribal nation in the United States is inclusive and you're a part of our family.
He estimates out of the 574 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., there are about a dozen bans still in place. The proposal will next go to one of the tribal government's committees.
That was Emma Gibson from the Mountain West News Bureau. A tribe in Connecticut is supporting a town's continued use of a mascot that includes an arrowhead and a profile of a Native man. NBC Connecticut reports the Scaticook Tribal Nation passed a resolution recently to support the city of Derby using the nickname Red Raiders and the logos as the town tries to retain funding that is jeopardized by its use of the mascot and imagery for local school athletic teams. According to a resolution passed by the Tribal Council, it supports the use of the images as, quote, a public means of sustaining Native American culture and history of Connecticut's first citizens. Under a law passed last year, Connecticut municipalities whose athletic teams use Native American names or mascots must get written support from a state or federally recognized tribe. Failing to do so means possibly losing grants funded by revenue from the state's two tribal casinos. Tribal and federal officials say an agreement to hand over more than 400 acres of land to the Rappahannock Tribe in Virginia is a triumph of collaboration among the tribe, the federal government, and private landowners. The agreement returns a portion of the tribe's ancestral homeland along the Rappahannock River. The tribe will manage conservation and management with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In a statement, Interior Secretary Deborah Holland said the department looks forward to drawing on tribal expertise and indigenous knowledge toward managing the area's wildlife and habitat. The agreement creates a permanent conservation easement that restricts how the sacred land can be used. And new DNA evidence has confirmed what a tribe in California has always maintained, that it is not extinct. USA Today reports an anthropologist wrote in 1925 that the Muekma Olon tribe from the San Francisco Bay Area was, quote, extinct for all practical purposes. But the tribe has always disputed that claim, and now living Olon tribal members have found a DNA link to their ancestors. A study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found genetic links between current tribal members and ancient inhabitants of the Bay Area. It used a type of genomic research that's only been developed over the last decade. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
The nonprofit organization Green Muslims aims to help people incorporate climate action into Ramadan. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. This year, April 2nd marks the start of Ramadan, a month of daily fasting and prayer for Muslims.
We're turning during this holy month inwardly to focus on our religion, to focus on God, to focus on improving ourselves. What better time than that to think about the service that we need to be providing to God as the stewards of the earth.
Sevim Kalyanju is executive director of the nonprofit Green Muslims. The group encourages Muslims to consider what steps they can take each day during the month of Ramadan to protect the environment and reduce climate change. To help, the nonprofit offers an online toolkit and a month-long calendar with suggested activities. They range from using less water and reducing food waste to listening to speeches by youth climate activists and praying outside to connect with nature.
We have to remember that God created this earth and that God placed us on this earth to care for it. So we're not fully practicing our religion unless we're making a concerted effort to care for the earth.
So Kalyanju says she hopes participation will inspire people to keep protecting the climate even after the month of Ramadan has passed. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Oregon has updated its strategy for protecting the wildlife-rich southern coast. That includes designating two new protected areas in the state. Eric Tegetthoff, once again, has more on the story.
Oregon has added new protections to unique areas along the southern coast, teeming with life. The State Land Conservation and Development Commission approved two designations, Coquille Point Marine Garden near Bandon and Cape Blanco Marine Research Area near Port Orford. Mary Garrett is head of Shoreline Education for Awareness, which proposed the Coquille Point protections. She says the area is home to a variety of wildlife, including seabirds and seals with their pups, and that it's beloved by locals and tourists alike.
We identified Coquille Point because of the fragility of the rocky habitat there. There's a lot of wildlife there that is impacted by heavy human traffic, dogs off leash, that sort of thing.
The Land Conservation and Development Commission also updated its Rocky Shores Management Strategy for the first time since 1994. David Fox is with the Marine Resources Program at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. He says the update to the management strategy will help protect kelp and other important seagrass, which grow near the coast and support an abundance of marine species. Fox says there is not a direct threat to the vegetation at the moment, but there has been in the past and there could be again in the future.
Those new policies are mostly aimed at direct human interactions, either with harvest or development impacts that might harm these algae species. So those new policies will add kind of a layer of protection.
Garrett says Coquille Point's view is awe-inspiring, and down on the beach, people find a completely different world.
The area has an abundance of marine life and just amazing nature. We have bald eagles that fly overhead. We have all sorts of amazing animals in the water, in the tide pools.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegetthoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, April 4th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes my